We need a real investigation. I don't think we have one yet.
Yes, it's true. And yes, it is a crime.
Well, thank you, Cleta Mitchell. Thank you for that explanation. Really interesting and kind of appalling.
Thank you,
really.
Tucker.
Cleta Mitchell is somebody with great courage, and she's involved with your litigation and lawsuits and all of this stuff. She literally gave up her whole practice not to get paid. She saw how corrupt it was, how disgusting it was, how dirty it was. And I want to thank you on behalf of everybody in this room and everybody in this country. You are a hell of a lawyer and tough. And that's what we need.
Welcome to Who's Counting with Cleta Mitchell. It's the podcast about all things related to elections, how elections are supposed to work, how sometimes they don't work the way they're supposed to, and what we as citizens can do to make sure that our election process in America is honest and that elections are conducted in accordance with the laws that are duly enacted by the legislatures. We are pleased today and honored to have as our guest, Lynn Taylor. She is the president of the Virginia Institute for Public Policy. Lynn is a longtime leader in Virginia and really across the country, promoting and advocating for conservative principles. And I'm delighted that you could be with us, Lynn, because we have a lot to talk about. And thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Cleta. I really appreciate the invitation. So excited about this podcast.
Well, Lynn, let's start by, let's introduce Lynn. Tell us, Lynn, about you, about how you became the president of the Virginia Institute of Public Policy. And we'll talk about the Institute in a moment, but let's, first of all, let's tell everybody about you.
Okay. Well, I grew up in Georgia, outside of Atlanta. And moved to Virginia just outside of the district about 30 years ago. So I guess that I could maybe claim being a Virginian now, and have been working in the nonprofit world for about 30 years. The Virginia Institute has been going, we're on our 26th year, and I have been with the Institute since its inception, as always a co-founder.
Oh, that's great. And so tell us about how the Virginia Institute was founded, why it was founded, and what it does.
Well, we began back in 1996 because at the time there was not a state-based think tank. And what we really wanted to do was to talk to Virginians about policies that we thought were important. So we started the Institute and have been working in a number of arenas for, as I said, 26 years. And that includes election integrity, although we didn't start off talking about election integrity. But I'm not sure anybody was talking about election integrity 26 years ago.
Well, it has that's one of the interesting things that's happened since 2020. I mean, the left talks about being woke. And I say that conservatives and patriotic Americans have awakened to the need for them to be involved in the election process. But so what are some of the policies and proposals and principles that I'm sure there are many, many, but what would you say are the two or three, besides election integrity, we'll get to that, but what are the two or three principles that have been particularly on the minds of the Institute all these years?
Well, we're certainly wanting to promote the founders' visions that came from us from, the 1700s. And of course, Virginia has, I believe, the most number of presidents of any state. And we're really proud to live in what is just a historical setting, to tell you the truth. And we wanted to bring these principles to life. And so some of the things that we work in besides election integrity include reduction of regulation and education reform, tax reform, telemedicine, and some of those types of arenas where we can really look at opportunities for entrepreneurs to really come forward with some ideas and things that would really work for us. Just to give you a quick example, we were working in telehealth before the pandemic and really put forward some policies on things that could help in telemedicine. And then the pandemic hits.
Oh, wow.
And the nice thing is Virginia was already on its way in order to help some of those areas really come and shine through. But we'd already been working on them.
So what, I mean, it's interesting because when you're talking about education reform, what do you mean when you say education reform? What are you talking about?
Well, we're really talking about having greater choice for parents, whether or not, you know, they may really enjoy being in their neighborhood school, in their public school. They may prefer to homeschool their children. They may like to have alternatives in online learning. Or have, you know, the possibilities of private schooling, that type of thing. And we just think that there should be many, many opportunities for parents and to find the right type of education for their child. So we really promote the policy of the funds that come from taxpayers to the state and then back to the schools, that really those funds should follow the students, not the institutions. So that is what we are promoting in our policies.
So I'm sure that you've done battle over the years with the teachers union and the school board associations and the very hidebound infrastructure that thinks that parents don't have a place in their children's education.
And that actually became right apparent this past year, just before the election, when one of the candidates decided that parents really should not decide what their children should learn. And it that rather exploded and exploded right into the election integrity folks who were really wanting to see transparency in their elections. And when these soccer moms turned into mama bears, they decided that the way in order to get things changed in their school system was to get involved in the elections. And we are so happy that they did.
So, all right. The Virginia Institute has been around for a couple of decades, more than that. And then suddenly in 2021, you found yourself in the middle of election integrity as an issue, which probably had not been one of your key issues before then. Tell us about that.
Well, we realized that after 2020, there were an awful lot of very angry people who thought that there was something fishy going on in that election. And I'm not sure that I disagree with those folks.
But when you say that election, you mean which election?
The presidential election in 2020.
Okay.
In November of 2020.
Right.
And I think a lot of folks were quite angry and really thought that something wasn't quite right in that election. And there were a lot of folks who were out there trying to prove that there was or there wasn't something wrong with that election. Well, one of the groups that we work with came up with an idea of putting together a summit in March of 2021. And this was really when a lot of folks, this is the first time they had ever heard the term election integrity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that this was something that just seems like it appeared out of nowhere. It didn't appear out of nowhere because there's been a number of people who've been working on this for a decade, but it just felt that way. And once we were done with the summit and everybody was really excited about it, and then people were coming out of the summit, go, okay, now what? Now what do we do? Because now we understand what the problem is. So what do you do about the problem? Well, some of the folks are looking at are still looking at the 2020 election and trying to decide if there was something that was not quite copacetic there. Others of us decided that, okay, what we really need to do is to focus on the next election. The trust is just gone in our electoral process. We realized there were polls taken and fully half of Virginians did not trust the whole electoral process. And it didn't make any difference if you were Republican or Democrat or an independent. You just mm-hmm. didn't trust. Now, was that true that you couldn't trust it? I don't know. I don't know if it was true, but it doesn't really make any difference because what is true is that half of Virginians don't believe that this is trustworthy. So what is it that we're going to do in order to bring trust back into our elections? And what we began talking with folks who were working around the state, trying to talk about, let's fix our voter rolls. Let's talk about the technology. Let's you know, look at the poll watching and the registrar's offices and the electoral boards. And we realized that a lot of things were going on in Virginia, but they didn't know about each other. Mm. And they all thought that they were the only ones doing anything in Virginia. Right. And so what we did is we brought together a coalition and we invited all of these folks who were working on these issues to come together and let's use this as a place where you can talk about what it is that you're doing, what you're seeing in your location, in your county, and see if we can help each other work through some of these election processes, because they can be very confusing.
Well, and you know, it's interesting because when you're talking about looking at the polls and half of Virginians didn't trust the outcome of the 2020 election, that's really mirrors what Senator Karen Fann, who is the state Senate president in Arizona, that's what she says about why she decided there needed to be an audit, because over 60% of the people of Arizona did not trust the outcome of the 2020 election in the presidential race. And so I do think that that's really important, is that for people to understand that what we're doing is not trying to shape a candidate's outcome or a political party's outcome. Tell people what, I love it when you say, when you give the history of Virginia, and when you talk about the principles of election integrity, tell people what you always say about that.
Well, you know, Virginia was conservative for, I don't know, a quarter of a century. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly it turned progressive. And it just, I wasn't sure whether or not this was actually what Virginians want. To tell you the truth, I, if Virginia wants to be blue, okay, that's great. If they want to be red, that's okay too. What I want is for Virginians to trust in their electoral processes. So as we've seen, you know, it was red for a quarter of a century. It turned blue in just a couple of cycles, and then it turned back red again. So what we're seeing is that by paying attention to the electoral processes, and this is not just the Virginia Institute paying attention to it. This is citizens from all over Virginia paying mm-hmm. attention. That they have this opportunity to make sure that the processes are according to the law and are according to the policies that the electoral boards have put into place.
Well, you know, one of the things I think that has really struck me in the last year, and I'm an election lawyer. I've been doing this, looking at elections and election mm-hmm. systems for a long time. But what I'm really struck by, and looking at state after state after state, and as you know, I concentrated in Georgia. But since that time, I spent time looking at what's happened in other states. And the number of ways, the myriad ways in which either the law was changed by a judge, mm-hmm. the laws were disregarded by election directors, secretaries of state, and that then the laws were not followed in certain localities where you have to have chain of custody for drop boxes or chain of custody for absentee ballots, or you have to have signature matching, whatever the law may be. And over and over and over again, the laws were disregarded. Virginia, I don't know that that has particularly been a finding or if people have really spent much time looking at that in Virginia. But one thing I do know is that one citizen researcher did an interesting thing, which is he looked on the state website of the Virginia Board of Elections, and it told the total number of absentee ballots that were cast in 2020 in the presidential election, just the total number. Mm-hmm. And then they also published a unit by unit, and in Virginia, it's not all counties, it's some cities, so they call right. it, but a unit by unit report of the absentee ballots cast in that unit. And he just had the idea to add those up. And the two numbers didn't match. There was about a 40,000 yeah. vote difference. And you think, how are people supposed to trust this? They can't even reconcile their own numbers.
And they still haven't reconciled those numbers.
So it's so right. It's those kinds of things that people just look at that and they go, come on, can't you get your act together and make this just make it work right? I think that's probably exactly right. as frustrating as anything. But so you had the summit in March of 2021 and had what? You had speakers who came. I think I talked to a couple of people who were headed there to lecture at, or to give presentations at that summit.
Right. Well, understand that we had had two sessions where we had over 60 election bills that had passed that had made all kinds of changes in Virginia's law. So, for instance, what they call ballot harvesting, which means that you can go and gather up as many ballots as you can find, and just one person can go and take them to a drop box or to a registrar's office. You don't have to actually turn your own ballot in. Or things like we now have you're not required to have your ID, any ID. Now, understand that if you want to go on an airplane, you have to have an ID. If you want to buy a bottle of wine, you have to have an ID, but you don't have to have an ID to vote in Virginia anymore.
And so what you're saying is that the legislature, which was controlled by Democrats over the last several cycles, and they basically, they enacted 60 bills to change the way in which elections in Virginia were conducted.
Yes. And one of those bills was passed last year, but does not go into effect until October, which is that we're going to have same day registration.
That's
so hysterical. You have no ID. You have same day registration. How is anybody supposed to find whether or not you're even a legal citizen in order to vote? They've just thrown all of the rules out the window.
Yeah, it's pretty shocking. And I think that it was, it manifested itself big time in 2020.
Yes.
But so you had all these changes in the law and y'all came together last March, a year ago, not quite a year ago right now. And what did you do?
So what we did is we put together a coalition and said, okay, well, what we're going to start with is we're just going to start with a telephone call every week and invite as many people as would like to join in a number of groups who are working on election integrity around Virginia, and just let them introduce themselves and tell what it is that they are doing. And then seeing if there is any way that this information sharing could help. And what happened is that just, first of all, it bloomed because they went from 24 groups to 60 groups, like practically overnight. We had a number of what we call local election integrity task forces, which are usually centered around maybe a county or a city. And what they did was they're putting together what is going on in their neck of the woods and talking about having people in the registrar's office. Now, Cleta, let me make this clear. We're not just talking about being there on election day. We're talking about people going in and asking the registrars what their processes look like and comparing those with what they're supposed to be. And then simply asking them, you know, are you going to move to what the law says? Now, I'd like to give a little example of this, if I may. Sometimes there are people in these offices who are nefarious, but sometimes there are people in these offices who are just ignorant.
You mean the people who are running the election offices?
The people who are running the election offices. We had one of our folks were in the registrar's office for another matter altogether and realized that there was this closet with a bunch of boxes stacked up, and inside the boxes were return mail. Well, what's supposed to happen is that the election office, the registrar's office, is supposed to send out a mailing to an address to see if the person is still there. If they are not, if the mail comes back undeliverable, then is supposed to be marked in the registration system. So that if that person shows up on election day or in one of the 45 days before, when they're allowed to vote and says, that's me, they have to prove who they are and where they live because the mailing that went out from the registrar's office came back undeliverable. Well, there's all this return mail sitting in the closet. So one of our folks said they didn't understand why it was sitting in the closet. So they asked the people in the registrar's office and they said, well, that's where we put the return mail. So they brought that information back to the coalition to say, okay, this is what I've seen. What does this mean? Is that what's supposed to happen? Is it just supposed to sit in a closet or a drawer? And this is where folks had an opportunity to talk to real experts in election law in Virginia. And so, of course, one of our experts said, no, it's not supposed to be sitting in a closet. It's supposed to go into the voter registration system. So what the gal did was she went back to the registrar and she said, and this registrar was relatively new. And she said, actually, those are supposed to go in. Here's the law, is supposed to go into the registration system. And he said, okay. And he went and got, he went and they went through every one of those return mail envelopes and they put all of that information back into the voter registration system. And it had everything to do with the fact that he was new and he didn't know. And so the question becomes is how much other things do these registrars not know?
Well, and you know, that's another thing. Somebody who's new and doesn't know, makes mistakes, doesn't follow the law.
Right.
But then you have these situations where you have registrars or election supervisors, as some states call them. They've been there for a long time and they don't really care what the procedures right. are. They've got their way of doing it and to hell with whatever the state board or the legislature has directed. Right. I've seen that happen in a lot of places.
Yes, it has. It has happened in Virginia. We do have folks who just think that their way is the best way. Unfortunately, we do have laws that control this, and we do have policies that come out from the electoral boards. And sometimes we just have to stand in front of them and say, this is what the law says. And if you're not going to follow the law, then somebody might sue you. And that's exactly what we did, was we sued the Fairfax County Registrar because he decided in his infinite wisdom that the last four digits of the Social Security number were not important on a application for an absentee ballot. And he's breaking the law. We told him he's breaking the law, and he seemed to indicate that he didn't care he was breaking the law. So we sued him.
Well, so people will understand, when an application comes in to an election office saying, please send me an absentee ballot, one of the required pieces of information is that the voter is supposed to put the last four digits of his or her Social Security number on the application, or they're
exactly.
not supposed to get a ballot.
Right.
And so he was just saying, oh, just ignore that little statutory requirement
right.
and just send it out anyway.
And he was telling the people that work with him or work for him, that they could disregard the law, which had to have made those folks very uncomfortable, because he is specifically telling them to break the law.
Well, if I remember correctly, the only reason that we even knew about it was because the members of the task force were in the election office
That's
working
right.
on something else, and one of the employees sort of sidled over and whispered, you didn't hear this from me, but he's telling us not to follow the law. And they were upset by that. They thought that they should be following the law.
They were, because they're Virginia citizens just like the rest of us. And they want transparency in our election processes. And it's just, it's not right.
Well, you know, I remember that, I guess the outcome of that, at least he had then had to sequester the ballots.
He did.
And so, talk about that a little bit.
Well, so they pulled those ballots from that came in because of not following the law. And we sued them, and we were, you know, ready to defend what it is that we were saying, that he was actually breaking the law. Unfortunately, the judge decided that we did not have standing. Now, here's the challenge. It could have been, the suit could have been brought by one of the candidates, and they chose not to because they didn't want to rock the boat. I mean, I understand where they're coming from, but I don't think that that's right. I think that you have to stand up for what it is that is right. So that's the reason why we came forward as a plaintiff in the suit, because we talked to Christian Adams, at at PILF, at the
Public Interest Legal Foundation.
Thank you. I just call him PILF all the time.
Yeah, that's true.
And we asked him to represent us, which he was happy to do. And we really appreciated that. And I'm really sorry that we were not able to go all the way forward, because I really wanted the law and the arguments for that law to be in the record. And unfortunately, we were not able to do that. But I think that what did come out of it was we had quite a bit of media about that. And I think it's important that other registrars saw that we were willing to go to the mat on this, that because you cannot just sit around and break the law and just have everyone
get away with
it. Okay. That's right.
Well, you know, one of the things that I've realized over the last year, and largely in no small part because of this lawsuit, but I find it amazing that left-wing groups can come in and challenge the validity of a duly enacted law. And the courts seem to just, okay, of course you have standing, but if citizens come in and try to say, we want to enforce the law as written, the courts half the time or most of the time said, well, you don't have standing. I just think that's something legislatures ought to write into their election codes. That's one of my new list of things that should go into election codes, is that if you want to uphold the law, you're a citizen who wants to have the law enforced, you ought to have standing. The court needs to be able to hear from citizens. And conversely, yes. I think if you want to invalidate a duly enacted law, it should be harder. It should be harder because they make these wild accusations about, that's what they did all through COVID and all, saying that, that the reason these election laws needed to be completely eliminated or changed by courts was they made these wild accusations about it disenfranchised people without having to show any particularized injury or even name anybody who had their voting rights suppressed. And they make these allegations that everything we propose that would strengthen the honesty and integrity of the election, from voter ID to verifying who you are if you vote by absentee, to requiring identifying information on applications for absentee ballots, things that 70-80% of the American people support. But the left calls those, calls that vote suppression. It makes no sense.
Vote suppression. I wish that you could have heard some of the folks who were testifying at the Virginia General Assembly, and they were absolutely taken aback by the fact that you think they can't get an ID. Right. They were absolutely outraged that anyone would think that because of the color of their skin or the amount of money that they make, that they could not get an ID. They get an ID for all kinds of things. And Virginia will give them a free ID.
A free photo ID.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, but you know, they don't pay any attention to facts. And right. It's very frustrating. But so what you're talking about is the involvement of citizens in your coalition.
Right.
And you said you ended up with, 60-something, 70-80 groups?
Yes, it's grown to over 80 groups now. We've grown after last November because people are beginning to understand that each individual citizen makes a difference. And they made a difference last year. And they understand that there's still a great deal of work that needs to be done. And they're coming, and folks are coming out, volunteers are coming out in droves because they realize that they can make a difference. And it all has to do with being in these registrar's offices and eyes on ballot.
Well, you know, I know that there were really active groups in Loudoun County and in Fairfax County and Richmond. And now I guess what you're saying is I know that there are more people participating in those now than there were a year ago. People did not go home after the election. They realized how important the work was, and they continue to be involved and engaged. I did a Zoom training for the Fairfax County Election Integrity Task Force, a about 3 weeks ago on a Tuesday night for an hour and a half, and there were 180 people on that Zoom call. It was just amazing.
And that's just going the folks through, that are involved in their task force.
That's just that one task force. That's one county, one task force. And they asked me so many questions. They're so engaged. And I was really blown away by that.
Well, there are about 18 to 20 local task forces now. And what we're trying to do is to increase those before the next. Now, understand, Virginia has an election every year. So before election season, we call it election season because we have 45 days of early voting. It starts in mid-September and goes through November every single year. And it is not changing for 2022. It is most likely not changing for 2023. So we know that we need to have folks who are there, who are paying attention. Let me back up for a moment and explain something about Virginia. We are required by statute to have parity in the when you are in early voting or on election day, if you are an observer. So what we have found out is that we just want all the observers to be following the law, understanding the law, understanding the process that has come about because of the law, and to help the people who are in those offices to stay close to that law, to understand what it is that they're supposed to be doing. And if they're not doing it, to speak up and to say something. And we don't care if those people are Republicans or Democrats. So we train everybody. You know, we want everyone to understand what the processes are supposed to be.
Well, I think that, and people may not understand this, but in most states, certainly in Virginia, this is the case, in other states where we're working this year, in order to be, you go through the training, but then in order to be assigned to be either an election official or a poll watcher, you have to get a certificate of appointment from your local political party chair.
Right.
And I remember in the training that Virginia Institute did, at the very end, it says, now you've been trained, here's the certificate, print it and take it to the political party of your choice.
Your choice, that's right.
So it's up to them decide.
So it's fine with us. We're not looking for a particular candidate to win. We're not looking for that at all. What we're looking for is transparency in our elections. We simply want folks to follow the law.
And we want to be able to see it to make sure that that's happening.
But and that's exactly what happened in the last election.
So tell us about your coalition. What were some of the principles that you established in order to get this coalition that grew to 60, 70 groups? What were some of the principles that you adopted to make sure that people could learn to work well together?
Well, you know, folks, first of all, believe that whatever it is that they're doing in election integrity is the most important thing that needs to be done, and everything else can just be jettisoned. We realize that that's really not the case, that there are lots of things that need to be done, and there's plenty of room for everyone. So what we did was we decided that the coalition calls were for specific reasons, and we call it SCIP, S-C-I-P. It's for strategy, coordination, information sharing, and it's the place where experts are twice a week. So if you have a question, you can come to this meeting twice a week and get your questions answered by an expert. What we did as far as the groups were concerned is we established very early on that we are interested in election integrity. We are not interested in the individual groups' missions. Now, if the working in election integrity forwards your mission, that's great. But it's not, this coalition is not there to forward any one particular group. So what we did is we required everyone to leave their logos and their egos at the door. Right. And we talk about that so much. I think people are afraid to show their true colors. And we tell them, you know, most of these groups are working on a lot of different issues. They can show their colors in a different issue. But right now, you know, in election integrity, they need to park them at the door. And we do exactly the same thing.
So, but the Institute, you really have, for people who want to learn how to do this, you do some things that really keep the coalition knit together. What are some of those things that you do for the coalition from the Institute?
Well, what we do is in managing the coalition and the coalition calls, we keep together a series of notes. We make copious notes about what it is that everyone's talked about, because understand, when you're talking about election integrity, you're talking in 87 different arenas and in 134 different locales. So we take copious notes, and what that has allowed us to do is, as groups join, they can just read through the notes and see what we've done, where we've been, answers to their questions, if that's what they've had going on, so that we don't spend time updating people or getting them up to speed when they join, because this coalition has been going on since last June, mm-hmm. sometime in that time frame from 2021. And what we have also done is we have brought the training to those areas that was put together by one of our experts. We also have, with the help of CPI, Conservative Partnership Institute, we've put on a summit last year in August, only, you know, 3 weeks before before the early voting began on September 17th, but brought together over 300 volunteers in Virginia to have some very specific training, not only on poll watching and being an election official, but also on what is it that you do for your vulnerable voters, your military voters, your folks who are in nursing homes and who may be in some group homes and things mm-hmm. like that. But we also so the entire summit was training in various and assorted issues having to do with, you know, what do you do with these absentee ballots? What are they supposed to look like? When things come back, what are you supposed to do with them? That type of thing. And what is the relationship between some of the mailers that are going out asking you if you want an absentee ballot and the U.S. Post Office and some of the left-leaning groups? What does that look like? So we really stressed training these people mm-hmm. so that they could go out and be advocates for transparency and election integrity in their area.
And know what the law said and what it's supposed to be, so they right. know what to ask for.
That's exactly right. And teaching people, how do you walk into a registrar's office and ask questions? There's nothing wrong with asking questions. Now, the way that you ask questions, there may be something wrong with that, because one thing that we've learned from Christian Adams is you want to be right and you want to be polite. And we teach that all the way through every course that we work on, is that you want to be right and you want to be polite. And so it was so successful that we are having another summit on April 22nd and 23rd. It will be in the Richmond area. And we'll be sending out save the dates on those just as soon as we have the venue nailed down. And we will also be working on some of those issues that we actually did not train on last time. Mm-hmm. Understanding that there were, because of timing issues where the election was coming up, there were not opportunities to work on cleaning the voter rolls, because whatever information you had could not be changed because of the specific timing in the law in Virginia. Those are things that we're going to be training on again, because cleaning the voter rolls is extremely important. One of the most important things that we can do. So we'll be having training on that, as well as a number of other issues, technology and poll watching, and there's a whole list.
Well, speaking of the poll watching, one of the things that I'd love to hear you talk about, how many people you train and how many spots you had to fill, and tell us about how that worked.
Well, if you sat down and did the math, understanding we had 45 days of early voting That meant that we had 14,000 slots to fill for poll watchers. Now this is, we're just a couple of months ahead of the beginning of the election season. So what we ended up doing was we were able to train 4,500 volunteers, and they covered 85% of those 14,000 slots. And in the largest county, which is Fairfax, understanding that Fairfax County, which for those who are in other states, sits right outside of Washington, D.C., has 1/7 of all Virginia voters in it. So we were really pleased that when during the actual election day, they were at over 90% on their polling places and, you know, their registrar's offices in order for to have that covered. So they
were covered 90% of all of their slots.
Yes. Yes.
That's pretty remarkable. And you started saying, Virginia does not register by party.
Right.
But the law does require parity between political parties in terms of filling the election official slots.
Yes.
And I can tell you from my experience over the years, no matter what state I've been to, there are always Democrats and Republican slots. And ask questions, it's, the Republicans didn't send us any names, or the only people who signed up were Democrats. But I know that the local task force in Fairfax County, they had people actually researching to make to see, okay, if somebody is filling a slot, are they... who have they given political contributions to? What do they say on their Facebook page about what candidates they support? And they had people actually doing research and then comparing the numbers of Republicans versus Democrats, or people who gave money and supported Republicans versus supporting Democrats, and kept going back to the registrar and saying, we have names of people. These people filling Republican slots, they're clearly not Republicans. Here are Republicans who want to do this job. And they kept pushing and pushing. And ultimately, they got to almost, not quite, but almost parity by the time of the election.
It did. It was really close. It was really close to 100%, which is phenomenal. And understanding, and what we're hoping that the other task forces understand is to take that to heart, that you can't just walk in and say one time, these are the Republicans who want to work here. And then when nothing happens with them, or they're not selected or what have you, you have to go back again and again to make sure that they're following. The law says parity,
right?
You need to follow the law. And if that's not what you want to do, then you need to work to get the law changed. But the law says parity.
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting because there's a young man working in Michigan right now, and he did an analysis of Detroit in 2020. And they have the same law in Michigan and they do register by party in Michigan. And they're supposed to have parity, 50-50, for whatever they call the election judges or whatever. They're people who are paid by the county or by the city. And out of more than 5,000 slots in Detroit, Republicans filled exactly 174. So they are really on a quest right now to be able to get to fill enough slots to have the observers. And not these are not observers. These are the paid workers election. And that's people don't realize, but that is so important. And all of this activity, it soon became an issue for the media. So
yes.
Talk about that for a little bit.
Well, they didn't. I think that probably my favorite article came out with the army of poll watchers. I think basically what we did was we surprised a lot of people with suddenly there were all of these citizens who are not only interested, not only showing up, but they are understanding what is supposed to be happening, and they're vocal. And it, like I said, they're right and they're polite. It doesn't mean that they're sitting and screaming at anybody, but they're simply saying, you know, this is the way that you bring trust back to electoral processes. And this is what the problem was. So really what we're trying to do is to solve the problems. But that is not exactly the way the media, or the most of the media, looked at it.
Now, I remember they sent an army of poll watchers and observers, and they went around and interviewed the registrars, people at the registrar's office, and some of them said, well, you know, when they ask me questions, that makes me stop and think and helps me do my job better. And others were kind of, we would like these people not to ask us anything because we're it's interfering with our work. And of course, that's become a real a talking point narrative of the left and the media, is to say that having all of these citizens involved in the process, as the statute envisions, by the way, the statute calls for it and envisions that elections are to be a joint effort of the election officials and citizen volunteers. That is the way it is written in every state. And there are some now on the left who say we have to, I think they're trying to intimidate people, our people, and say, if you come to the election office and ask questions, that that's somehow intimidating or threatening. And that isn't the intent. And I don't really, I don't know that we had any complaints about that during the time when those thousands of slots were filled. I didn't hear any complaints about that.
No, and there weren't any complaints about that. And I'm really concerned, you know, when we heard and the media came out, they were talking about, you know, the DOJ was going to be coming in, and there was a hotline set up to the FBI where the registrars could call when somebody was, you know, had come into their office. And I don't really understand what all that was about, because I don't know of anyone who went in and did anything wrong. We got no complaints. As far as I know, no one was kicked out, you know, for doing anything wrong. They were right and they were polite, and they were written citizens of that county, and they should have every right to be there.
Well, and then they follow the process. It isn't that they just show up and congregate. They have to be trained. They have to, in order, before they can get the certificate appointing them of appointment, the political party has the way that it decides whether or not that person is sufficiently trained and whatever instructions they want to give them. And I know that there's been a real push, at least on the Republican side, to tell people, you know, always be polite. Do not lose your temper. And really, if somebody has a hard time with that sort of thing, I mean, I think that there's been a move to say, don't let that person go into the polling places. We don't need people to lose their temper, get angry, and that kind of thing. But citizens doing their job that the statute gives them the authority to do, getting training, going through the process, being appointed. Most of them volunteers. I mean, even the people who got appointed as election officials, or if they were going to be paid, they're not getting rich on that.
These are tiny amounts
of money.
And in the training, we're very specific about this is what you do if you see something that you think is an anomaly. It's just, you know, we tell them, step one, you go and talk to the chief. Step two, if you're not getting satisfaction on your question, there is a whole list of steps of what it is that you need to do, including calling the hotline to talk to an attorney about it and let them decide what needs to be done. You know, whether or not that is an election electoral board member who is making a call, or putting out a letter, you know, to clarify what a policy might be, to make sure that everyone understands exactly what it was supposed to be. And if there's any misunderstanding, because sometimes that can happen, but there is a list of steps, and none of it involves, you know, cursing anyone or being, you know, unruly. None of that's in the steps.
Well, you know, one of the things that I thought was interesting is just watching how those local citizens groups evolved, and they would be there and they would see things and come up with things. And one of the things I thought was most interesting is in Loudoun County, they realized that if you looked at the voting machine at the end of the day and saw how many votes had been cast that day, they came up with the idea of, you better go over and look and see how many people had signed in to vote that day, and do those numbers match? And they had to do it at the end of the day, because the next morning, the machines were reset at zero.
Right.
They were not.
Right.
And so they kept a record. They made the last person in the last shift on early voting would mm-hmm. make a note and mark that down. So they knew how many votes had been cast each day. And they would look at the poll book to make sure that the number of votes that showed up on the machine matched the number of voters who had been signed in. And if there was a discrepancy, they could deal with it in real time and not have to
exactly.
wait until it's over. And I think that that in and of itself is just all of these things. It's making sure that the chain of custody is followed and that you have the right kind of seals. I know there was a big discussion about thumb drives and
yes.
what manner would be used to be able to transmit the final tabulations from the county or the unit to the state board of elections. But people really talked about that. They studied what the manuals
yes.
procedures said, and sometimes those are not very clear. But they spent time ahead of time studying so that they would know when voting started what it was they needed to do. It was very impressive to me, this army of citizens.
And they came back to the coalition talking about what it is that they had learned, because they wanted to teach other local task forces what they were doing, what they were seeing, what they were not seeing in some cases, and what needed to be done. And that's how we all learn on, because they're not necessarily all the same machines in all of the counties in Virginia. So this became very important. And one of the things that I think was tremendously effective is that the folks who were in a local task force were talking among themselves. They had reports that they did at the end of the night that was sent out for the folks who were coming in the next morning, so that there was a continuity in watching what was going on. And so everyone knew what everyone else had seen or not seen or should be looking for, or if they had a problem and how they resolved that problem, which was extremely important, so that they as they went forward, they really were solving problems in real time, not waiting until after the whole thing is over, trying to find evidence or processes or procedures or figuring it out, and then everything is gone. They were solving these problems in real time.
Well, you know, I think that one of the things that I'm sure is very gratifying to you is that the Democrats didn't win any of the statewide offices, and they didn't win. They lost control of the state house, But I did not see or hear a lot of, I don't think I heard one time that the election itself was fraudulent or it was illegitimate. There was something wrong with it. I just think that that has to be our mantra, that if our side wins, that the legitimacy is accepted because it is legitimate. And if our side loses, that it's accepted.
If my
people lose. And I think that that is still the thing that is hard for a lot of us about 2020, because we see over the last year what a mess so many of these places were. And we talk about that on the podcast. And I've had people from different states talk about what happened in their states. I think that one of the best things that we probably haven't even talked about very much in Virginia is that we really haven't, I have heard no complaining, even by the Washington Post or anybody else, that there was something wrong in terms of the manner in which the election was conducted. I have not heard that
That's
from
right.
anybody.
No, we have not heard that either. And I think it has everything to do with the law says parity. We have someone from both sides. They're both watching. They're both seeing exactly the same thing. And they're both, you know, can bring about the changes that need to be made if the processes are not carried out correctly. That it can come from both sides. It doesn't have to come just from one side. And I think when we realize that we're watching from both sides, who can say that something's gone wrong?
Well, I think that too, that one of the things that bothers me about the 45 days of early voting is that it makes it really, I mean, the election systems were set up so that voting would be conducted in a manner that was capable of being observed.
Right.
So you could make sure that if somebody's bringing in an elderly person, there are laws protecting that elderly person or the people from the group home, that you can't just have somebody come in and just basically manipulate how they vote. Right. And vote for them. But when you move everything out into into absentee voting, you've done two things. You've removed it from the ability to observe, and it makes it really hard to staff those slots because there's such an extended period of time when you've got to find people to be the volunteers and the workers to make sure that things are done properly.
That's absolutely correct. And what, as the paper said, you know, an army of Virginians came out to make sure that there could be trust in this election process. But there is a huge problem with the absentee voting, because if you're not going to have some way of telling whether this person should have gotten an absentee ballot, whether they were able to do their own ballot, was it picked up from the mail? Was it voted by somebody totally different? You know, because sometimes these you know, the application pieces go out and they're already filled in with everything except for the last four digits of the Social Security number. So how do you know that the person is the one who's asking for the absentee ballot when the registrars are letting it go through without the four digits?
We know that there are these national progressive groups that sent out a letter saying we're going to send out 2.1 million applications for absentee ballots in Virginia, and they did. They certainly
did. They did. Yeah. I got one. Apparently they know where I live. So yes, it just makes it far more difficult, because understand what are we trying to do? We're not trying to come up with a particular outcome. We are trying to come up with transparency to build trust back into our electoral processes. That's the goal. And I think that we achieved a good bit of that in the last election.
I think so too. And I think it also taught people that they can make a difference and by doing their part, because they're still staying with the process. I want to just touch briefly on one last area. And that is what's interesting is that a lot of the people who were engaged in the process last year have stayed engaged in the process this year for purposes of getting some of those laws that you made reference to that were safeguards were removed, and trying to get some of those things reinstated in Virginia, which is a little hard to do when you have a House that's controlled by one political party and the Senate was not up in 2021. So they did not change hands. So they're controlled by the Democrats. The House is Republican. So probably not a lot is going to be done this legislative session. But I've been very interested to watch how the coalition has worked on legislation. Can you talk about that a little bit?
I can. Part of what Virginia Institute does is what we call our legislative impact program. And what we do is we take those policies that we believe to be best for freedom and liberty, and we put those into play. We draft legislation. We draft model legislation that can be picked up by legislators or other groups and put into play in a General Assembly session. We do it actually for more states than just Virginia, but in speaking specifically to Virginia, we did a number of model bills about the election and things that we thought that needed to be put back into place, like voter ID, getting rid of same day registration, that kind of thing. And we have not been successful in getting the folks who are in the coalition have not been successful in getting that all the way through the General Assembly, because it gets killed in the Senate, to be quite honest. The Senate is controlled by the Democrats. They changed all of the rules over the last couple of years, and they don't want to give that up. Okay. So the folks who are working still in the coalition And you're right, we've actually grown, and they have been looking at the laws and working with some of the new options, you know, that were going through the General Assembly session. But they also know that even though, you know, we all wanted to change that 45 days, it's not changing.
Right. So not now.
It might in the future. We're certainly hoping that it does, but it is not changing for 2022. So that means that the work that we did in 2021 is just the beginning. And we need to have many more who are working in the registrar's offices, going to talk to their registrars, being there for the 45 days, and they understand it. And the nice thing is they're willing to do it again.
That's what's great. So now then you've had a lot of people saying from other states saying, how did you do this? So tell everybody what you've done and what you've created and where they can get a copy.
Well, I think I have my background blurred, but what we put together was what we call the Virginia model. And all it does is it talks about exactly what we've been talking about here, what we did and how we did it. And we are just honored to represent the thousands of Virginian citizens who came out to make this work. And if you go to virginiainstitute.org, there's a place where you can pick up the, we'll send you a, gives you a PDF, takes you to a link to a PDF, and you can download it yourself. Or if you want to let it, you know, send me an email and I will send you one if you would like to have one. You can send it to info@virginiainstitute.org. And we are always happy to give you as many as you would like.
Well, that's what I think is so great, because there is, you've taken the time to prepare something that tells people how you created this statewide coalition. And now you and I together, we're going to go around and we're telling other people how to do it. And I appreciate all your help and summits that we're doing, that CPI is sponsoring, but we couldn't do it without you, Lynn, because you are the mama bear of the coalition. And we appreciate that.
Well, I'm so excited because there are now at least five that are up and running and doing exactly what we're doing in Virginia, which is so exciting that they're doing it in their state. Because as you know, and I'm sure that your listeners know, every state has different laws. You can't just, it's not one size fits all. And you have different people and different players and need to do different things in every state. And I'm just so excited that it's not just Virginians who are excited about election integrity. It is many other states. We get lots and lots of calls, and we're always willing to help.
Well, I hope you got a lot of calls after this podcast. There's a lot to do. But as I say, I just look at it as the statutes say that citizens are supposed to be involved in the election process. That's what the law says. And for too many years, I think we all just thought, I didn't, because I'm in the business of working in elections, and have been in my whole law practice. But certainly I've seen so many things that I just have always thought, gee, I wish people would care about this and get out and get involved. And much the same way that parents have gotten involved in school boards and realizing that they need to go to the school board meetings. They need to be asking these questions. Same thing with elections. We need to go to those board meetings and we need to be asking questions. And the electoral board members, they need to know they represent the public and they need to be beholden to the public. And so it's really gratifying, exciting to me to see that maybe people are now realizing that we have to be involved, we have to be engaged. And you have shown the way, you've led the way, and all we have to do is just do what the Virginia Institute and the Virginia Fair Elections Committee or Coalition and Lynn Taylor have done, and then we can fix all these problems in our elections.
Well, we'll at least be working on them, but it is gratifying to see that folks are beginning to realize that you don't just go to vote on election day and then you're done. You're not done. This country is run by its sovereign citizens, and they need to show up.
Well, that's a great way to end. And we thank you, Lynn, for all of your time. I know you've got a million things to do. We're teaching some people in North Carolina in the next several days. We're teaching about just how to do what we just talked about. So We thank you, Lynn, and we thank all of our audience, our listeners, our viewers, and we thank you for joining us for another episode of Who's Counting with Cleta Mitchell. We urge you to visit the website of the Election Integrity Institute, the Conservative Partnership Institute, and the Election Integrity Network. Our email address, our web address is www.whoscounting.us. If you go there, we need to post your Virginia plan on our website. We'll do that.
We'll be happy to send that to you.
We'll put a link on there so that people can go to our website also to get copies of the Virginia plan. And there you can also download copies of the Citizen's Guide to Building an Election Integrity Infrastructure, and a lot of news about what's going on the election integrity front in states all over the country, as well as in Congress, as we try to fend off the bad things that people in Washington are trying to do.
Yes.
So with that, thank you, Lynn, and thank you to everybody. And that's a wrap. That's another episode of Who's Counting with Cleta Mitchell, and we look forward to seeing you in our next episode. So thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to Who's Counting. The Who's Counting podcast is produced by the Conservative Partnership Institute's Election Integrity Network. It is filmed and recorded at CPI Studios in Washington, D.C. Help us grow this show by sharing this episode with a friend, and be sure to subscribe and to give us a good review. We need your word of mouth, because big tech can't be trusted and tries to cancel us daily. Help fight back by visiting whoscounting.us and sign up for this podcast, for our newsletter, become part of the Election Integrity Network.